Welcome back to the Next Frontier podcast. In this episode, we're joined by Ed Murr, CEO of Machina Labs, a company at the bleeding edge of the cutting edge of metal forming technology with its robotic craftsman platform. We'll explore the genesis of Machina Labs, its innovative approach to manufacturing, and some of the ways that it will impact just about every industry in the United States and around the world. And it'll impact your life too, on a day-to-day basis. Join us for a deep dive into how Machina Labs is reshaping manufacturing and some of the promising insights into the future that Ed is going to share. Machina is truly at the bleeding edge of the next wave of physical industrial innovation, and their technology will change the world in ways that we'd never expect. With that, I hope that you enjoy this epic conversation with Ed Murr, CEO of Machina Labs.
First of all, thanks for this conversation, and it's this great opportunity to talk about manufacturing. I am currently CEO and co-founder at Machina Labs. My area of passion is manufacturing, and how can we make it more accessible to different ideas? I think that hasn't been traditionally the case. That's why we started Machina Labs, my co-founder Babak. On day-to-day basis, we're in the process of kind of scaling our company. We had a technology that we have shown to our customers how it works and what kind of advantages it has. And my day-to-day right now is about kind of scaling that, hiring the team, making sure we have enough capital to be able to make the impact we want to make.
So with that said, could you provide us a brief overview of what Machina Labs is, what you're working on, and what the mission of your company is?
Yeah, so the long-term mission at Machina is about how can you basically enable manufacturing to be accessible to all kinds of ideas, right? And that's a lofty goal. But basically for us, that comes down to being able to have manufacturing processes that are basically don't have economies of scale issues. Usually you think of economy scales as good things, but in manufacturing actually has some downsides, meaning that it's much cheaper to make a million per price part. It's much cheaper to make a million of a part than you make one. So I'm really excited about figuring technology that allows us to make your first part as cheap as your millionth part, right? And that's what we're focused on Machina Labs. Being able to build factories and do manufacturing with technologies that are not product specific. Meaning that you can easily change design, you can easily change material without having to change your machinery or your factory, which is unfortunately not the case today in manufacturing. And that's at the root cause of a lot of problems we see in manufacturing. Obviously, the one we talked about is the speed of innovation, how fast ideas can become reality. But also it's at the core of a lot of other issues such as centralization and supply chain challenges, because current factories are very product specific, meaning that you have to make a lot of the same part before they can become economical. And that means one factory is building the parts for the rest of the world. That means it's got centralized in one area of usually cheap areas of labor, and it has to ship parts for the rest of the world. That means you have supply chain challenges and centralization issues. And then offshoring is as a result of that, right? So I think it's a core problem at manufacturing that we are hoping that partially with the help of other companies also focus on this, be able to solve it and improve it in the next few years.
As we're going through, we'll dive deeper into the technology, the specifics of the innovations, and how your experience played into those innovations. Before we get there, and to keep it a little bit general for what Machina is, I'd love to explore more about the mission and the vision just to set the stage. Then we'll back up, dive a little bit into your experience and lessons that you've learned along the way that are enabling you to pioneer here. And then we'll come back to the technology as well. But could you dive in a little bit? What does success look like for Machina in 36 months from now? So I imagine it's beyond just the pioneering of the technology in the robotic manufacturing processes and new manufacturing processes. So what is the vision? What is that 36-month vision?
Yeah, 36-month vision is our ability to be able to get a part from a customer and deliver it in literally a matter of days, hopefully hours, after the customer sends us that part. This is completely going to change the manufacturing, at least in the areas that we are focused on, which is currently on sheet forming. Traditionally, a customer that wants to form a sheet of metal is looking at, five months lead time before they can get their first batch of parts. The fastest ones, they're looking at 3 months of lead time. So really in 36 months, if we can have a technology and package it in a way that a customer can go from a design to the first part in matter of hours and latest in a matter of days, and then be able to iterate on that, finalize their design, and then use the same technology to go to higher volumes, that's a big success for us in sheet metal forming and trimming.
So with that said, in this sheet metal world, right? So let's say we're just talking sheet metal right now. What does the business model look like there? So is it manufacturing as a service and building a manufacturing shop around your new technology? Is there a as a service model that is interesting around what you're building and designing, et cetera? Is there a software component? Can you walk us through how the machine of Machina the system works, and what is the system to support that faster lead time turnaround look like?
We are actually basically coming up with products that solves our problems the way they want to solve it. We don't want to necessarily force a flow workflow, a certain workflow to our customers. So right now we have multiple ways we offer our technology. The most straightforward way, especially in early stages of design, is that we manufacture them here in our facility for them. So right now we work with the customers, we get their designs, and then our engineers kind of turns it into instructions that will run on a robot, and the robot will manufacture that part. The robot will scan it, will tell them exactly how off it is from the geometry that they want it, design that they want it, and we'll ship the parts to them. Now, as we are kind of getting more mature, we're going to expose more of those software tools we use internally to our customers so that they can more directly be able to manipulate their designs and kind of submit it for manufacturing. And that's the dominant way we do business today. So folks reach out to us. We have a facility here in LA. It's a 30,000 square foot facility. We have 22 robots deployed that allows us to make parts for the customers very rapidly. But we also have customers like, for example, United States Air Force, where they have certain applications where this capability needs to be on site. So we are also in the process of deploying these machines to their facility. For example, this year, we have one of our machines being deployed to a Air Force base in Atlanta. And that allows them to basically directly work with our software, prepare a part to be run on a machine, and then have the machine on site to manufacture. So both ways, both in terms of selling parts and selling machines, we're just here to, serve customers the way they want to be served.
So to summarize, there's really two paths and two business models that you guys are pioneering. Number one is at the core of all of it, you've developed a specific technology and process, which we'll get into next. You've developed a specific technology and process where you are uniquely capable of providing different functions as a result of the forms that you're able to shape using your proprietary and innovative manufacturing process. And you've stood up, say, 22 or so cells in your facility to meet demand and customers' requests to produce these parts that you're uniquely suited and capable of producing. And then on the other side, you're pioneering and prototyping how you might use your proprietary manufacturing mechatronics software, hardware system to meet other specific customer demands that they might have to produce proprietary parts in a specific scale and for different use cases than just inside of your shop.
Yeah, and as you pointed out, it's a very multidisciplinary product to build. We have all the software components of it that allows us to figure out what is the right instructions that the robot needs to get to form the part. And that's a combination of both classical software, but also a lot of newer techniques in machine learning and empirical modeling to figure out exactly what you need to form. But also, we develop a lot of end effectors and tools that the robots pick up to do the operations. So a lot of mechanical engineering work, the fixturing of our product and parts and tooling that goes into that. And also a lot of material science recipes. We are processing alloys, that traditionally were very hard to process. For example, for some of our customers, we're forming titanium today. That traditionally is very hard to form in room temperature. So we also have to do a lot of work around. We have a team internally, a material science team that develop recipes to process these materials. And then also lots of interesting robotic work. You know, for us to be able to do what we do, we have to basically make robots so accurate on their dynamic loads. And these are loads that can be during our process, that can be as high as the weight of a truck, right? Make sure the robot stays accurate, can still go fast, and can basically do what we needed to do to get the part processed in the right way. So there's a lot of robotic work that I also done. So it's a very multidisciplinary product, and we are offering in this two ways. We either install it in a customer facility, or we offer it as a service and we manufacture parts here in our facility for them.
Cool. So now I'd like to explore both how sheet forming, which I'm hearing is what you primarily focus on, is traditionally done. And in addition to that, this podcast will be primarily delivered over audio. I think we might only go over audio because that's the way we deliver pretty much all of our podcasts. And eventually we will make use of the video at some point in the future. But right now we're really over audio. So if you could describe for our listeners, I'm looking at these beautiful screens of your robotic arms applying whatever forces they're going to apply. I'll let you go deeper into it, but I don't think that they have the visual representation of what the product is that we're talking about. So if you could just for a few moments describe the manufacturing process and give us a little bit of a visual description.
As you mentioned, manufacturing is a very visual field. So I encourage people to go on our website and kind of see the robots in action. We have a really good video of the facility and the robots in action, and that gives them a good understanding. But at core, we are basically replicating what craftsmen used to do with material, right? You know, if you look at 1600s, manufacturing was mostly done with blacksmiths and craftsmen, and they were super flexible. You know, one day they could pick up a hammer to make a sword, and the next day they would use the same hammer, but apply it differently to make like a shield, right? Super flexible. And we kind of lost that flexibility a little bit with the current manufacturing paradigms. With industrializations, we have now factories that are very specifically built for each product. They can make the same thing over and over and really fast, but they cannot easily change geometry and material. So what we are trying to do with our platform is, can we get that concept of craftsmanship? And can be scaled with robotic, can we basically build a robotic craftsman? So if you look at our robots, they're basically, right now we have two robots in each manufacturing cell. These robots can pick up different tools and then apply it through change in software in different ways to the material to replicate different types of processes. The first process we are using this platform for is for sheet metal forming. Traditionally, if you want to form a sheet of metal, you usually have to go, dominantly, you have to go with a process called stamping, which you have to have these giant presses, 90, 100, sometimes more in terms of pressure presses, and then have two dies, a male and a female. You put a sheet in between them, and then through brute force, with the force of a press, you kind of form the sheet into shape. So the challenge with that is that you have to make those dies. You have to buy a stamping press, but you also have to make the dies that are every time they're specific to the geometry they're trying to process. So every time you want to change your design or your material, you have to change those dies. And those dies, I don't know for folks who have been in just stamping and automotive manufacturing, they're very expensive. They're like size of a, you know, sometimes like 12 foot by 5 foot, 15 foot by 10 foot dies that cost up to $1 million to make. And you have to iterate on a bunch of those dies before you get to the right dies. It's a very expensive process. So the way our robots kind of disrupt that is basically we don't need a die, right? Two robots coming from two sides of the sheet. Imagine a sheet that is fixtured between two robots. And then the robots come in, they have a stylus looking at the vector, and they start to deform the sheet, the two robots together. They start pinching and deform the sheet the same way a potter forms a clay bowl with their fingers, right? So they're coming and pinch and stretch very incrementally, layer by layer almost. They basically deform the sheet to get to the final part.
So Ed, just to clarify, these are robotic arms, right? So traditional cobot arms that there's a variety of different models for them out in the market. But just to give listeners a real vivid picture, we're talking robotic arms.
Yes, like think of a robotic arms you would see in a regular, automotive assembly line. We're using the same type of robots. They're relatively big. I mean, people look at these do cut out videos, and I feel like, you know, it's like it's not as big as they are, but they're like 30 foot by 30 foot manufacturing cells that have these robots in them. So yeah, we are using off-the-shelf robotic, and really the core ingredient is what tools they pick up and what kind of a software and models do they use to form the sheet of metal.
So is your software hardware or robot agnostic? And then I'll take that to another dimension and say, if Elon succeeds with TeslaBot, will there be TeslaBot robo blacksmiths, or is the form factor of the, 10-ton robotic arm critical?
We are robot agnostic today, right? And that was one of the things we wanted to do, right? You know, we love our robotic partners, but you know, there's a lot of vendors out there, if you look at KUKA, FANUC, that are, you know, they're differentiated sometimes in software, but at the core, they're offering very similar products. So this allows us to be able to work with whatever vendor that we have to do because we developed the software from scratch. We're not using taking advantage of any specific software features that these robotic vendors give us. So we build the whole control software from scratch ourselves. And that allows us to be able to use whatever robotic arm that our customers want or is appropriate for the task. So we have, so far we have used different vendors already. You know, inside our facility, we have used like KUKA robotic arms, we have used FANUC for some of our customers, depending on their need and the relationship they have with the robot providers. In terms of if it is a Tesla robot can do this at some point, maybe for thinner sheets. I think there is a component of how much force the robot can apply. So we need to go, you know, we're still like applying like the weight of a truck sometimes to deform these sheets at the end effector. And I don't think, you know, like a biped robots necessarily can do that. But maybe if they hammer hard, you know, like you have to pick up a hammer and use like some kinetic energy to kind of increase the stresses on the part, maybe. But I don't think it's a very viable solution.
Oh, I guess you didn't listen to the last Tesla call because Elon unveiled a the Cybertruck of Tesla bots. It's the shape of a Hulk. It's just as big.
Oh wow.
No, I'm joking.
I
It's
had no, they
total.
didn't.
They don't just have the base version anymore. They now have Tesla Hulk.
Tesla Hawk. I love that. I love the idea. Maybe we'll use that one.
Tesla Hulk, cool.
Tesla Hawk would be good.
That would be pretty cool. So just to reiterate, so you're unlocking new capabilities, number one, first and foremost, with the alloys that you're able to now effectively not stamp but form the sheet metal for. You're removing some of the mold requirements when it comes to needing to produce molds to form sheet metal. How does this process work for, say, non-aerospace grade parts and volumes, if that makes sense?
That's a very good question. Actually, we already have had some customers in the automotive world, right? You know, when you think about it, you're immediately your mind goes into area of like low volume. You're like, okay, this is perfect for low volume, right? And you're right. It's very good fit for low volume
It's
because if you
perfect for
have,
low volume exotic materials, is where my mind immediately goes.
exotic material even more because traditionally you can't do exotic materials, but like even let's say with aluminum or regular steels, if you're doing, you know, a one part and you have to spend $300,000 to $400,000 in a die, then that cost of that one part becomes $300,000 and you have to wait 4 or 5 months. So even in that case, you're like, okay, if I'm making 10 parts, 100 parts, maybe it makes sense, right? It's really shines there. And you're right. And that's the area we are focused on early on. But you know, one thing I always try to do is like, you know, start thinking about like, you know, well, what is that number that it's going to break even with traditional technique? Right, like what number the traditional technique is better, and surprisingly, when you start doing the math, it's the number is pretty high, right? You know, I was talking with some of the folks who speaking of Tesla, some of the folks we know at Tesla about how much does it cost them to put a stamping line together. There's a video of a stamping facility in Berlin for Tesla. This is like a at least a 200,000 square foot facility, 300,000 square foot facility that you need. The stamping machines are like 3 stories tall. You need as much that there's on the ground, also on the ground that you need as much under the ground. So you're looking at 70, 80, sometimes $100 million investment on a stamping line that can maybe manufacture, you know, 5,000 parts a week, right? So with that, how many cells can we put together in the same facility size? And you start looking at like, you know, I don't want to necessarily disclose our BOM cost, but like we will get very close to the output of a stamping in terms of the type of, but the same cost. You get very close to the output of stamping with what we can do with ourselves.
You're saying per unit when you take the CapEx and the OpEx and put them
Yes, and
together.
take that and say, okay, like, this is one stamping machine that can do 5,000 parts a week. How many cells can I buy with that in the same space? And collectively, what is their throughput? Because they're gonna be working in parallel, right? And the number is not too far from sometimes from that 5,000, depending on the geometry. So I think it is also a very viable option for going to a higher volumes, but definitely we're starting from lower volumes today. But we have our eyes at higher volume as we make the process a little bit more efficient and it's scaling it. But the good thing is, if you have a facility that has hundreds of our cells in it, you can easily change geometry. You can also change the process those cells are doing, because right now, not only we do forming, we also do trimming, we do surface finishing, we do bending. So the moment you're done with your first 5,000 parts, then you can reconfigure it to do trimming. You can reconfigure it to do another part. So then you start thinking about, oh, okay, maybe it makes sense for higher volumes as well. But anyway, that being said, I think that's kind of like a little bit longer term. The current area of focus is chem in low volumes, because that's the area that we very immediately win, because some people already made investment in the stamping, right? So we cannot just say throw away your stamping investment that you did. But we can definitely shine indoor lower volumes very immediately.
Okay, clarifying question there. So there's novel aerospace alloys that you really can only form into the shapes that they want to be formed into with your process at low volumes. And then on the other hand, there's very large volume, not necessarily the most advanced alloys, automotive, where there is the, $50 million P&L or CapEx to go invest in standing up your own new lines. But smack dab in the middle in between, and where a lot of our audience might lie is in the small, medium-sized manufacturing world. And one of the companies that I work with recently, they're having one of their key stamping providers go out of business. They make, say, the parts are maybe deep draw stamped, maybe no more than 8 inches in height and about 18 inches in diameter, for a range of parts in between. There's several stages to what they're trying to stamp. Say 1,500 units a year, something like this annually. Where does that volume fall in terms of the development of your technology on the roadmap, where you're aiming to get to, and who you're servicing and the capabilities?
So right now, we did a quick calculation. So the way we do calculation today, we say, okay, let's forget about when we find the break-even point. Let's say, let's forget about your $50 million investment in equipment. Let's just compare our technology, the amount of investment you need to make in a die, right? Which is kind of the incremental investment you have to make. So that number right now, the sweet spot for us, around 3,000 parts per design. So as long as you're doing 3,000 parts per design or lower, we are doing much better today. Now above 3,000, I think today, the dies win. But like I said, as we have more cells, and the goal is in the next few years, have facilities that have tens, if not hundreds of these cells in it. And the moment you have that, then we can start thinking about, okay, if it's a new application, you've got to go and make that investment at $50 million investment or $100 million investment in your stamping line. Maybe it makes sense to work with us, even if it is, 100,000 parts per design. But again, I think always there's going to be a good spot for, like, if you're doing a million parts per design, probably stamping makes more sense, right? You want to just go with that. But our goal is in the next few years to kind of push that ceiling from 3,000 to higher numbers.
So that 3,000, that's annually
Just per design, actually, right?
per
Depends
design.
on, because what we do is say, so, okay, you invest some amount on a die, and then how many parts that die gets you, and then how many parts our technology can
You're
get
saying
you
over the
over
course of the die's life.
die's life. Yes, exactly.
Okay, that makes sense. Thank you for clarifying that. That's helpful in terms of framing these technologies, because a lot of times, particularly when interacting with the tech world and that and the venture-backed hard charging world, I see a focus on the aerospace market, which is obviously wonderful, and there's lots of great technology to be built there, and that's usually where a lot of the technology starts. But giving the audience a sense of where this, it's not really technology readiness level, but it's kind of like the small, medium-sized business readiness level for the technology, if that makes sense. Because we talk about these technologies, they're freaking awesome. And everyone's like, okay, how do I use it? And how much is it going to cost me? So painting that really helps to interpret and analyze and understand some of the more tactical components of a conversation like this. So I appreciate you going down that rabbit hole. Next question about your technology. You guys can do some cool things. So relative to old school stamping, what are the top 3 to 5 new features and capabilities that your process and process physics unlocks relative to some of the other manufacturing methods?
Directly, when we talk about comparing it with stamping, there are new material that we enable. A lot of material, because the way material flows under the die, some material are just like not easy to form in room temperature. Like, for example, titanium is one of those. And we are allowed, we basically, we our technology enables us to get more formability out of material, sometimes 4 times more, in some of those materials that are hard to form. So enabling titanium is one of those things. But also, like, enabling alloys that traditionally, forming alloys that traditionally didn't even make sense to make a die for because the volumes were so low. So, like, for example, like Inconel parts or parts that are, we talked about refractory alloys, niobium parts. These are like, mostly have applications in places where like the volume is not high, so stamping never is considered. And forming sheet metal is never considered. So we are kind of opening up applications for those alloys. We recently formed Inconel. We recently formed niobium, Invar, which is used dominantly in composite tooling because it has basically zero thermal coefficient of expansion. So those are some of the things. In terms of material, we enable some of those material, but also in terms of geometry, we can enable part consolidation, right? Because traditional stamping, you cannot have a die that has more than, less than few, like, 5, 6, 7, 10 degrees of draft, because your part gets stuck on a die. The moment you have overhangs, you cannot get your part off of a die. So now with our technology, we can do those overhangs because you can form a geometry and then go into those angles that the die cannot reach and start continue forming more there. And that allows us basically to reduce the process steps or potentially reduce the number of parts. Instead of making multiple parts that you have to assemble together, now you can make one part. So that's one other area. And then surprisingly, our technology also enabled sheet metal to used in applications that were traditionally not available to sheet metal. For example, composite molds. That's actually one of our biggest business lines today. Traditionally, if you want to make a composite part, you have to make a mold and you lay up composite on top of it, and then you put it in an oven and you cure it. And those molds are usually machined. And if you have, like, you're like looking at a wing mold for a wing of an aircraft, that's a very big wasteful process. You have to start from a giant, billet of material, and then start removing material until you get your wing surface and then lay up on it. Now we kind of replace that with a basically formed surface that you can lay up on top of it. And that has been one of their biggest areas of being able to make tooling for composite and sometimes plastics as well. And then there was one other area that kind of recently opened up, and we're working with Navy on, is in some applications when you have a very large part that needs to be out of a special, kind of metallurgical product, you have to use powder. Basically, what they do is they have these casings, they pour powder in it, and then they put it in a hip oven with pressure and heat. They turn it into a solid part. But in order to make that casing, a lot of times it's a lot of like cutting sheet metal and welding it and kind of like piecemealing it until you have a casing. So we are working with them to form those casings in out of less parts. So that was another new application that I never thought of it. I always thought, okay, we're going to replace some stamped parts. And then the moment we kind of enabled this technology, all these applications popped up that were never available to sheet. And now we are enabling.
That's quite cool. I'm going to ask you about process physics in a second, as it seems like there's something that is different about this than stamping on the process physics side, but we'll get there in one sec. There's another application, another two sets of applications that I'm curious about. Number one, I think one of the coolest material science tricks I've seen probably in 5 or 6 years was in a video. You had a, I don't remember, I don't know what the material was, probably a steel, where you locally changed the magnetization of the crystal structure and the grain structure. Can you talk about that? Because that's, sorry for everyone who's not a material science nerd, but this is an essential conversation to have because that's pretty freaking wild and unique to be able to do that without having to have thermal processing or predefined materials processing.
No, that was a stainless steel alloy, and it was funny. We were talking with one of our advisors when once we realized that's happening. And depending on basically some of the alloys, especially like complex alloys like steel, have a lot of interesting phases that can be basically created when you are processing the material. And we realized, like for example, if you start from 304. And then you start deforming certain areas, the amount of strain, if you put a lot of strain in certain areas, the phase of the material changes. So in that case, the areas that got deformed and strained became magnetic, while the areas that did not have a strain in them stayed non-magnetic. And we realized like, oh yeah, so that some areas that we basically touched with the anode detector, it's becoming magnetic. And we showed this to one of our customers and ended up finding an interesting application for it. They were doing these inserts. For their cabinets. These are tool cabinets they have in hospitals. So they have these trays where they put tools in it, and they realized we can actually make the sections where you put the tool magnetic. So this automatically just grab, like if the tool has a magnet in it, automatically just goes into that section that has been deformed. So an interesting application out of that came out as well. But yeah, no, there's a lot of cool things we can do because we locally, very locally and surgically, we process material. We get these type of effect. And actually, that's rooted in the other question you asked, is that why do we get more formability out of the material? Is because of that. Because we can go locally exhaust the formability of the material. And we are mostly, we have different mechanisms at play when we're deforming. We have a lot of bending going on, which has more capacity in terms of formability. So sometimes for some of the alloys, because of the way we process it, we can get up to four times more depth of drop. And that's what enables us to form like alloys like titanium that traditionally wasn't possible with the stamping.
So is it still super plasticity?
It's not super plasticity. I think this is a good conversation to have with our material scientist, Babak. So
Yeah.
I'm gonna butcher it. But it's just because we are basically, you know, when you're deforming the material, you are depending on what operation, what process you're using, you're basically triggering different modes of bending and shear, and those depending on what kind of how much of each you have, you can kind of get more formability out of the material. But I think I don't want to butcher it because I
Yeah,
think
it's
Babak
okay.
will explain it the best way.
Another question for you on the process capabilities. How are you able to make, say, casting molds or injection molds using this this process, depending on the alloy that you're working with?
It's an interesting. I think we haven't done that before, so it will be tough for me to say if we can or not. I have to talk with somebody who's an expert in the field to kind of talk about it. But I think we have done plastic molds and composite molds, but those are at different temperature and that kind of different requirements. But I think depending, we are doing some high temperature alloys like Inconel or some of the high temperature steel. So maybe, but it would be an interesting area to explore.
I'm asking, and not that we have to go deeper into it, I just see a pathway beyond the sheet metal disruption, but the mold making capabilities that are unlocked here. There's another friend of mine. I don't know that he wants me talking about this publicly, so I won't say names or go too deep into it, but who is kind of innovating in one area, and that innovation in that singular area in manufacturing is unlocking quite a larger set of new it's not process physics, process engineering and capabilities along these axes. So that's pretty tremendous. I remember I was working at Makerspace in college when Form Labs came out with their castable 3D printing resin, if you're familiar with what I'm talking about. And that was because at the University of Wisconsin, where I went to school, within like a mile radius, you can literally make everything that you could possibly want to make. There's a foundry in the bottom of, in the basement of the material science building. And I'll never forget the first time that someone printed on the Form Labs printer at the Makerspace, took it over to the foundry and cast a, I don't remember what alloy they were casting, but that was a profound moment for me where it's not just the capabilities of the printer, but it's what what second, third order processes are made possible through that material science and process engineering innovation.
Yeah, no, that those are always good surprises, because also on the, I know we're going to cover this in a little bit later, but like when you're like trying to make a business case for a technology, you never think of those things, right? You think of like, oh, I'm replacing sheet metal parts. And this is the market for sheet metal parts. And then you go into the business and you're like, well, 20% of my business is now composite molds. That was not even part of the sheet metal market. Mm-hmm. So those are definitely nice surprises that people use it in interesting, creative ways.
Yeah. And I mean, you would never go machine, say like an Inconel casting mold, because it's too freaking expensive in terms of the Inconel. But if you're using probably a hundredth of the material that you would use to shape an Inconel mold, because you're now just forming an Inconel mold out of a material that's a hundredth, the thickness you would need. That's pretty wild.
And some interesting kind of things shows up. Like, it's funny because we ended up making these molds for composites. And then the benefit they have is that, you know, sheet has a much better heat profile, like a surface temperature profile, because it doesn't have depth. Right. So like the composites cure better on a sheet mold. So there's all these interesting benefits are getting unlocked that like we weren't even expecting.
Let's see where we should take this conversation next. Is there anything else on the process physics side, technology side, the actual fundamental atoms of what you're doing that you think would be valuable to talk about and educate the audience on?
No, I think, you know, we kind of covered all of it. I think one thing I'm excited to kind of also just kind of mention is that, you know, we apply this platform of what we call robotic craftsman to sheet forming. But really, one thing that really got me excited was, you know, how many other processes within the same platform can we do? Because the robots, you know, right now we do trimming as well, right? And that's why I'm really optimistic about our platform as a kind of thesis on what future of factories can look like. Can you have these cells where, you know, they form, they drop a forming defector, they pick up a trimmer, and then they trim, they drop a trimmer, they pick up a tape layup, and they do composite layup. They drop it, they pick up a welder, they do some additive features. And I think I'm really excited about that paradigm, and hopefully we can kind of contribute to that. It's a tangent to the atoms, but you know, in terms of capability, I'm really excited being able to go beyond sheet forming with the platform that we have.
Yeah, I see a future where you have, you know, the raw material come in one side, where our supply chain just gets down to raw material, and I'm not even talking like raw steel. I'm talking like not ore necessarily, but a much greener form of material than even factories today typically work with, where you're then have, you know, you're a robo blacksmith. Okay, where's the robo foundry, so to speak? Right. And you robo foundry into a robo blacksmith, or you robo foundry into a printer, or you robo foundry into whatever the case might be. Right. So it's interesting to kind of focus on unlocking that robo, let's pick up a hammer and bang stuff either at temperature, you know, with precision force applications, depending on the process physics that you're dealing with. So to summarize, you're working on kind of the robo blacksmith layer of the local manufacturing stack.
Right.
Does this tech stack scale down linearly? So do you need a ginormous robot? We touched on this a little bit with our Tesla Hulk thread. But how does this scale down to where, if say someone owns a ranch, and they're like, hey, I'd really love to have my own robo blacksmith on my 40, 50 acre ranch, because I'm a nut job who likes to, not nut job in a negative way, nut job in a potentially a very responsible way. I like to be able to have, you know, access to these capabilities locally, but I don't want to have to run a lathe. So I'd love to be able to have a digital blacksmith here that I just got to tell it what to make, and it'll make it if I give it the material.
Yeah. So the way I think about it, fundamentally, in order to process material, you need three things. You need ability to manipulate material, which robotic gives you. You need to know what you want to do with material, which is software side. But then you also need to bring the forces of processing material to what the robot can do, right? So we have focused on the first two pieces, which is the software piece and manipulation ability. The third piece is something which is on our roadmap, because that's what unlocks what you were saying, right? Because right now we have to have very strong robots so that their forces are high enough they can manipulate, let's say, a 5 millimeter steel sheet, right? Which is not easily doable with a human. Like, it doesn't matter how hard you hit it with a hammer. What the blacksmith does when they want to deal with that thick of a metal, they put it in a furnace, and then they heat it up and then they hammer it. So the piece that we're missing today to be able to have robots that have a smaller, maybe a footprint or smaller forces they can apply, is adding that layer of material property change. And usually you do that through heat. But there's other ways that you can use ultrasonic. You can do a bunch of things to kind of bring the yield of the material lower so they can actually process it with lower forces. And I think that's for something that's in our roadmap. Today, because we don't have that, we have to rely on these heavy, big, bulky robots that can apply the force of a, weight of a truck. But I think on our roadmap, we have plans to include what we call material conditioning. And that's the ability to basically bring the yield of material so that, weaker robots get manipulated. So that's the last piece we need to add. And I think if you have those three pieces, you have flexible mind, you have flexible manipulation tools, but you can also change the properties of material, then you can do all kinds of processes with the same robot.
What is the range of pressures that you would need to apply, starting with, say, bronze, taking you all the way up to Inconel?
We are looking at, like, for now in our process, like, I mean, bronze obviously, like, a different class that you're not focused on, but, like, stop looking at
Aluminum,
aluminum
yeah.
or mild steel. That are, they're looking at, like, putting, 200, 300, 400 newtons. That's basically like
How
80
many trucks,
pounds.
how many Toyota Priuses is that?
That's just 80 pounds. It's like basically like,
Okay.
size, force of a, weight of a, weight of a,
Yep. A
weight of a child
person. Yeah.
person. And then all the way we have, some of the thicker steels. Some of the thicker Inconels, we're looking at 18,000 newtons, sometimes 20,000 newtons. And the 20,000 newtons, you're looking at basically 4,000 pounds, 4,000, 5,000 pounds. So that's kind of the range today. But then that gets us to, let's say, 4 millimeter steel. The moment we want to do a 6 millimeter, 7 millimeter plate of steel, or do a very high strength, high carbon steel, then the robots can't do it unless we can bring the yield down through some form of a material conditioning. It can be a laser that heats it up, or a heated end effector, or a coil nearby that brings it, through induction, can heat the material as we're forming it. And those are kind of like the future of what we're looking at. Can we bring material conditioning into this equation as well?
In theory, process physics wise, this could be makerspace sized or desktop sized with low stress requirement material, say an aluminum or a mild steel.
Yeah, quarter a, millimeter or half a millimeter, 1,000 aluminum, you can probably do it on your desk.
Great. So maker movement and prepper movement, watch out. Coming soon. Cool. So last question on the tech is on the software side. So it seems to me that a lot of your IP is on the mach is really in the machine learning algorithm around the process physics that you're innovating. Can you tell us a little bit more about what's going into that and what type of challenge that has been, and how you've went about even starting that problem?
The main challenge with our process, is, so I'll step back a little bit. Like, so think of a stamping. So stamping creates a die, and then when you for you through a press, you're putting applying pressure to the sheet, a male and a female. The material doesn't have any place other to go other than basically either tearing or getting the shape of the mold. Right, so kind of through brute force and through physical constraint, you're shaping the material. When we are forming it the way we are forming it, there are two end effectors that are deforming the sheet. The rest of the sheet is moving in all kinds of different ways. All right, and also after you move away from the sheet might spring back in different in different again into a different shape. And the key is to be able to predict if I am going through to apply these type of a path and these type of forces to the sheet. What is the end result? What is the parts going to look like? And then once we have, let's say you have a magic box that tells you, if I run this, this is the end result that I'm going to get. They cannot inverse that magic box and say, okay, if I want this part with this a level of accuracy, what are the process parameters that I need to start with? And that's the core problem we're trying to solve. And usually that exists in the mind of a craftsman. Like, you know, if you're a sheet shaper, you're forming with a hammer, you look at your part, you'll be like, okay, this part needs to go down, this part needs to go up. And you do something that looks non-intuitive for somebody who hasn't done it. You do hammer certain locations more, and then you get the part to that shape. So that is the model we have to build. But we need to build it in computers as opposed to someone's mind, right?
So the way it's craft GPT.
Craft GPT, there you go. That's a good name for it. Maybe we should think about that. But the idea is, yes, can we build that model? Now, there's multiple ways we build that model. For example, being able to predict the forces that we're going to have to see to form a certain part. So that's something we have done in the past. What are the forces required to form this geometry? And then make sure robots close the loop with those predicted forces. And if we do that, then we're going to have the right part. But also starting looking into like, okay, I'm going to scan the part at every layer or every step of the part and try to basically create a function that turns my input process parameters into the resulting parts. And whatever that machine, whatever the machine learning come up with, whatever black box model, that's the model I'm going to use to predict what process parameters I'm going to start with to get the right part in the end. And those are the type of things that we're trying to do. Traditionally, people used physics-based simulation for these things.
Do you define that?
So basically, if you look at academia, a lot of times if you want to predict what's going to happen to a material that goes through a process, there are some physics simulations that people do. And these are like, there are multiple methods. There are finite element methods. There are computational fluid dynamics methods that allows you to basically capture the physics that we know, the equation of the physical equations that we know, and then implement it in a set of equations so that it will give you what is going to happen to the part. But that relies on those equations being right and the assumptions behind those equations or the constant that goes into those equations being right. Most of the time, those simulations are not accurate. And also, they take a long time. There's a lot of computation you have to do before you get to the right part. For example, for our case, for a part that takes 15 minutes to form, we have to run 1 week of simulation before we can predict what's going to happen to it. So what we ended up doing is like, okay, let's not do physics-based. Let's try to capture data as we are forming these parts. So put sensors in our machines and then use the data to build the same model, but in an empirical fashion, in a machine learning fashion, as opposed to physics-based. And so as you can imagine, the challenge there is how much data do you have access to? So we had to build this system, not only to capture data, but allows us to generate a lot of data and then use that data to build these models. And then, you know, how good is the data, is how good your sensors are. So those are all the challenges that we have to make sure that we can kind of account for as we're gathering data and building model based on that.
Cool. Craft GPT. Freaking love it. That's a great approach to problem solving that I think. How does the compute look for that on the physics-based simulation versus the brute force data approach that you took?
Basically, for the physics-based approach, you're solving these like systems of differential equations. You know, you're looking at like, you know, last when the part that I told you that takes 15 minutes, we're simulating it in a week. That is on a 27 core machine, a really beefy machine with like, you know, 128 gigs of RAM, like, you know, like pretty beefy machine that takes a week. So obviously you can parallelize it as opposed to building models based on empirical data. You can just some of these models can be built on your laptop, right? But the nice thing, once you build the model, then you can query it much faster. So you can query it in even on a simple on embedded machine that is on the robot. So significantly reduce the computational need when you move to these empirical models as opposed to physics-based simulation. But also just improves your accuracy because it's just based on the data you see as opposed to based on physical assumptions that you have to make in physics-based simulations.
There's a core piece of wisdom in there that I think, for me, I'm learning and I think is relevant to kind of succinctly articulate for the audience from what I'm observing you say, Ed, and that's you can't control the whole world, nor should you try. Sometimes you just got to get out there and build shit and see what goes wrong and what goes right and learn from it.
Data that you get. And don't make assumptions. Don't sit down and like try to create these physics-based simulations. That's actually a good takeaway. I love that.
As we're getting near the end of our time together, Ed, I have a few questions. Speaking of lessons that the small business world, small, medium-sized manufacturing world, and not necessarily the tech Silicon Valley venture-backed world, might take away from this conversation. A couple of rapid-fire questions that I have queued up here. In your opinion, which company in the United States is the most I advanced in manufacturing today and why?
That's a good question. I have limited exposure because like I've been mostly in aerospace defense. The funny thing is, I think it's tough to answer that because I think manufacturing is still very much a craft. You know, I remember when we were, I mean, I want to say SpaceX because I really loved working there. But again, when you think about it, you know, it was all like sequence of problem solving. Like, you know, we had, you know, I remember I was talking, I had a dinner with a few of the SpaceX folks yesterday, and we had this guy, his name was, we called him Big John. And, you know, when you run into problems, he would just figure out a way how to manufacture that part and figure it out, you know, and even in the most innovative companies, you still have that level of craftsmanship and I think that's what makes manufacturing work at the end of the day. There's a level of problem solving that you do, and you're not just relying on technology. So it's hard for me to answer that question. I really liked the way we solve things at SpaceX. That I wouldn't call it like, you know, when you say what is the most advanced, I think people don't think of it as like something that's fully roboticized and everything is just working like a clockwork. For me, it's like people have ingenuity to figure things out and do it in a fast way and do it in an effective way. And I think that's what I saw at SpaceX. There might be other companies that are super more technologically advanced, have like fantastic like robotic lines. But I'm more impressed by when people get creative.
Even your LinkedIn resume, which is really the only encounter I had with you aside from a couple of YouTube videos before we hopped on the horn here, I'm assuming that you've interacted with a non-trivial amount of manufacturing companies outside of where you've worked, whether they be vendors or they be potential prospective clients. You've still had a breadth of experience working with non-techie traditional VC-backed companies, which is a weird thing to say, but I guess that's the reality we're living in, that non-VC-backed companies are non-traditional for the tech world. What non-startup, non-traditional tech name, niche manufacturing company do you respect the most? If you can't disclose because of NDAs or whatnot, if you can just give us an idea of what they do and what you respect about them, I think that could be informative.
So non-traditional, you mean like so VC backed
Not
or like not
non-traditional
VCs?
being not VC backed, and at the same time not Lockheed Martin, if that makes sense. Not GM, not Ford.
To be
Like
honest,
small, medium-sized business. Yeah.
I'm really impressed by Haas.
Haas. Okay.
Yeah, I mean these guys like, you know, their machines are everywhere. I mean, they're still super good at service. You know, we have some of their machines down here. You know, it's still, I think it's a, I if I think I, if I not mistaken, it's a private company. It's like a $300, $400 million private company. Their machines are all around the world. They're the guys who made CNC available to everybody. They service pretty fast. They know what they're doing. I don't know. I take a lot of inspirations. That's what our team does. It's like, well, Haas is doing it this way. Should we do it that way too? So I'm really impressed by them for sure.
Can you rapid fire a few of the like details or things that have su surprised and delighted you about working with Haas's equipment and them as a company?
The most important thing is they do what's right for the customer, right? You know, their facilities are out there. I think there are a lot of companies who are constantly thinking about like, you know, how can I create leverage with the product that I have to just make more money? I think Haas was like, you know, their machine can be anywhere. We've got to service it. We've got to do whatever we can for the customer to be able to use our machines and get our products. But I think the most impressive thing with them is like the cost is pretty cheap. I mean, compared to some of the other, they're very, very cost effective, but also like very great service. You know, we call them, they're here, they fix things up and they're out of it. So yeah, I think a combination of cost and service.
What lessons on the tech and production side have you learned from how Haas goes about producing their equipment? It seems like it's a similar intention, similar form factor, similar tech stack. What lessons have you learned there?
I think there's a lot. I think we should definitely kind of like touch base on this, you know, because we're still earlier stages, right? We're still like, you know, maturing the technology for our customers. We do a lot of hand holding. We do a lot of like close collaboration with our customers. But I think figuring out exactly what your product is, how to sell it, and then how to support it, you know, like Haas doesn't do like they don't offer machining as a service, right? They're like, no, we sell these machines as a service. I mean, they're doing a very good job of that. Like being able to really kind of like really figure that out and figure that out for your customers. I think that's something I really appreciate about them. Now, that might not be exactly what we would do, but like, what would that be for us?
You've been around the block when it comes to, you know, big name companies, so to speak. And I'm imagining you've integrated a lot of that experience into your work at Machina. So small businesses, medium-sized businesses, traditional manufacturers don't get that exposure to, say, a Google or a SpaceX or a Relativity. And there's a lot of lessons learned when you have that scale and that venture backing and that enterprise level that you miss when you're owning and operating a small, medium-sized manufacturing business. Now, the flip side of that is there's a lot of flexibility and opportunity that you have as a small, medium-sized manufacturing business that you don't otherwise have when you're at that larger scale of enterprise, venture-backed, et cetera, mm-hmm. when you don't have access to that capital. Because again, you decided to stay privately owned, maybe your family owned and operated. That's a whole discussion in and of itself. But my question for you is, what lessons did you learn working in those different environments? Let me know if there's anything else to add to this list, but Google's on your resume, SpaceX, Relativity, Microsoft. You already talked a little bit about SpaceX. What are three lessons that you learned working in that scaled environment that you're applying in your business today? And that you can, if you were a giving a keynote at a conference about small, medium-sized manufacturers that you would include in your keynote?
I mean, first of all, I mean, we look at U.S. manufacturing ecosystem, there's a lot of small SMBs, like small, medium business businesses, mm-hmm. medium-sized businesses. So, I mean, they're the backbone, right? You know, mm-hmm. especially in the manufacturing. You know, I think venture-backed businesses has an interesting, unique quality where, like, if you want to be a venture-backed business, you have to inevitably promise a very big return. Right? You need to come up with an idea that gives you a huge margin and huge market. That's just the game there, right? I know people, you know, kind of sometimes make fun of some of these businesses, but that's just the reality of that type mm-hmm. of a business, right? You know, nobody wants to invest in a business that is going to be like 20% more on the venture side, and it's going to be 20% margin and the market size is $200 million. Like mm-hmm. it can be a great small business, but like, it's just going to have a very hard time attracting capital from venture community, because they're going after those moonshots because like they're looking for one out of 100 that's going to make them a lot of money, right? And that significantly affects the way you operate, sometimes not in a good way. So obviously you pointed out sometimes it's in a good way where you have a lot of capability, or you're innovating, a lot of people get excited about your product. I think so, and that those are all the good things. I'm kind of basically almost answering the opposite of your question. I think the only thing you got to watch for is along the way, make sure you're building a very good real product that at the end of the day, solving people's problems, and you're not necessarily going after this giant carrot that you put for yourself. And like, you know, it's going to be a huge, like say margin business in a huge market that like basically detracts you from actually building a very good, useful product very early on. I think that's something we are hopefully we're balancing very well at Machina. There can be cases where you go after too big of an opportunity, too big of a pipe dream, and sometimes things don't pan out the way you want it.
Yeah, lots of times with the statistical successes of startups in the venture world. I'm just to reiterate the question, because I think there may be a kernel of wisdom that you can offer in addition to the prior one that you offered. Operationally,
yes.
What lessons come with that level of scale that, you know, that an operator, a CEO has the opportunity to even think about with that level of scale and the capital available that is accessible to an SMB, but an SMB might not otherwise think about?
Yeah, I think it's a good question. That's why I'm like, you know, I kind of danced around that question and kind of gave you the opposite of it. I think one thing that we learned a lot from, I would say abroad from Google and Microsoft, and then the space it kind of applied to the hardware industry, was that how fast can you iterate, really? And it comes down to basically, you know, when you're developing software, there's, you know, there's this known wisdom where like, you know, you want to get to failure fast, which doesn't exist in a lot of small businesses and a lot of also hardware businesses, is that within your means, if you're trying a new idea, how fast can you try it? How fast can you fail the idea? I think a lot of times when you're in a small business, you really focus on being like, I'm really in love with this idea. I'm going to just push it and I'm going to bank everything on it. Figuring out ways to test it really fast. I think that's a common culture in the companies I've been, SpaceX, Google, Microsoft, is that what is the fastest way to kind of test potentially an idea we have that we want to implement, either with the customers, operationally, how can we do it in a smaller scale? And can I get a lot of learning from it? But I think this is a good question. I think we should talk about it again at some point. I think I have to think about it more.
Cool. Thank you so much, Ed. Well, I appreciate your time. And finally, how can our listeners stay informed about your work, Machina Labs' progress, future developments? And with that, do you have any calls to action for the audience?
I mean, we try to be keep the folks updated in our social media accounts. Specifically, I think LinkedIn. I'm not a big social media person myself, but our LinkedIn is pretty active. We put a lot of videos of our process and the type of customers and contracts we're working on. So I encourage people to search for us on LinkedIn and follow us there. We also have Twitter and Instagram accounts that we also put updates on. And our website is machinalabs.ai. And if anybody wants to kind of start looking at some of the parts we can do for them, definitely send us an email at info@machinalabs.ai. Also, I know a lot of folks that might be listening are folks that are want to get into manufacturing and maybe want to figure out where's the company that maybe working on some of the cutting edge in manufacturing. So we're also hiring a lot of folks. So it's machinalabs.ai/career. If you go there, you can kind of see we have, I think, 20 something roles open across different engineering and operations.
Thank you so much for listening to this episode of the Next Frontier Podcast. If you would like to follow along, learn more, dive deeper into our content, we are now live on Substack.com. You can head on over to maxgoldberg.substack.com. That's maxgoldberg.substack.com, where we're publishing all of our podcasts from now on, all of our blogs, some long form essays, and some other fun goodies along the way. The podcast is still going to live on anchor.fm/nextfrontier, alternatively at nextfrontierpodcast.com, where we'll use it to distribute our free content to Apple Podcasts, Spotify, etc. For now and to eternity, as long as Spotify and Anchor continue to host us. Anyway, housekeeping updates complete. The conclusion of that is head on over to maxgoldberg.substack.com to subscribe and follow along for our content.